Wizard of Oz. We hear he is a wizard of whiz, if ever a whiz there was. If ever, oh, ever a whiz there was, the Wizard of Oz is one. Because of the wonderful things he does. We're off to see the wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz.
This is The Wizards of Money, your money and financial management series. But with a twist, my name is Smithy and I'm a wizard watcher in the land of Oz. This is part 8 of the Wizards of Money series and it is entitled Trading Nature and Cooking the Books. In this, the 8th edition of Wizards, we're going to take a look at what drives companies to cook the books or lie about their earnings, and we'll investigate just how widespread this problem might be. How much of the global economy is based on smoke and mirrors bookkeeping wizardry? Is such fake wizardry a genuine weak spot in the financial system that could ultimately lead to a meltdown? These are interesting questions for people to ask, and it is especially useful for activists to identify such weak spots. Book cooking is a topical issue in the wake of the implosion of the amazing disintegrating wizard collection known as Enron. Both inside and outside the financial world, people are asking the question, how many more Enrons are out there? In this episode of The Wizards of Money, we will first look at the pressures behind book cooking with a glimpse at the wonderland of accounting. Then we'll take a look at the activities of the once mighty Enron Empire, from its contributions to America's energy policy to its attempts to privatize the world's water supply and turn Mother Nature's gifts, from the weather to forest to wind, into tradable securities. Finally, we will look at the mechanics of the accounting trickery that ultimately led to its demise, enriching top executives while rendering employees' pension plans worthless. We'll look at the Enron collapse from a perspective that's a bit different. We will see that one of the primary forces driving the Enron collapse was the battle of the Enron giant's desire to privatize nature and turn all resources into tradable securities versus the public's desire for fair access to these goods. Interestingly, one of the key markets involved was the water market that we spoke about in Wizards Part 7, entitled The Money Cycle versus the Water Cycle. In this episode, we will interview a former Enron trader and risk manager. We will also hear some excerpts from a January 2001 interview with the now disgraced former CEO of Enron, and also hear some excerpts from a recent congressional hearing on the Enron collapse. You can get the full text of all Wizards of Money episodes and further references on the Wizards of Money website at www.wizardsofmoney.org. We'll begin this episode of Wizards by talking about some accounting basics and the mirror image of assets and liabilities. Financial accounting basically runs the world. This is so simply because money and finance run the world. And we have learned from previous editions of Wizards that money is just an entry on a balance sheet. Base money, or currency notes, and bank money, or bank deposits, make up what we will call the plain money supply of the non-bank public. As we saw in Wizards Part 1, plain money is simply the equivalent of the liability side of total bank balance sheets. On the other side of the bank's total balance sheets, we have bank assets, which correspond to the liabilities of the non-bank public, in the form of things like home mortgages, car loans, and credit card debt. And so this process of mirror imaging continues right into all other forms of financial asset. Any financial instrument is simply a balance sheet entry on two balance sheets. A financial instrument is an asset of one person and a liability of another. In this fashion, all financial instruments, be it money, stocks, bonds, or options, have a mirror image somewhere in some other book or in some other computer. All financial instruments exist merely as entries in a computer or a book. Even the dollar bills we use have a mirror image liability on the Federal Reserve's balance sheet. Financial instruments other than plain money, let's say stocks and bonds, have bookkeeping entries that are usually a claim on some other financial instrument, often plain money, at some date in the future. Any such bookkeeping entry can be used to generate future money, or can be transferred into different bookkeeping entries, or can miraculously be transformed into a real good, such as food and clothing, through the process of trade. This is how the zero-sum game financial system works. It is all based on the shuffling of mirror image numbers around on bits of paper and as bits and bytes around in computers. It is, of course, quite bizarre that this number shuffling governs so much of the world order and defines social relations and access to the basics of life. But the reason the number shuffling game has so much power is because people have so much confidence in it as a way to define the social order and govern the distribution of real goods. Let us look at this confidence in the number shuffling that runs the world from the perspective of two different groups of people and how these two groups come to have the confidence in this number shuffling that keeps the financial system alive. First of all, we'll look at the low-wage worker or unemployed person. For this group, the dominant financial instrument in use is just plain money. The instrument for which the underlying number shuffling of mirror image items around balance sheets is less obvious. Confidence is maintained in this number shuffling system partly through ignorance of the maneuvering that is actually going on to create and distribute credits and debits, but mostly through sheer necessity. The latter arises because there are only limited alternatives to money for distributing goods. But this is now changing with the growth in community currencies, as we discussed in Wizards Part 6. At the opposite end of the spectrum are the very wealthy people, for whom plain money is much less significant as a financial instrument. Plain money for this class is merely a transitory stage between transactions in financial instruments and for converting financial instruments into real goods and services. In today's world of very large wealth gaps, the wealthy have accumulated lots of excess financial capital. As in most past money-dominated empires, they tend to lend out this excess to finance other projects in return for more money in the future than they are lending out today. So they might buy stocks or bonds, which form familiar balance sheet entries in the form of debt and equity to the borrower and stock issuer. The mirror image of these bookkeeping entries are, of course, assets on the wealthy person's balance sheet. For the financial system as we know it today to survive, it is this very wealthy class, above all others, that must keep confidence in the global number shuffling game. For, if they lost confidence, first they would try and liquidate or sell all their financial instruments and hurry them into safer assets, which would probably first be just plain money. But there isn't enough money to liquidate all these assets, which are really claims on future money. In this situation of mass selling, the markets would actually freeze up and cause some kind of financial meltdown. This wealthy class can cause a financial collapse more easily than any other class because they have the most financial assets and access to money on such a massive scale that they could force change very quickly. This means that they must retain confidence in the bookkeeping wizardry or number shuffling that goes on to account for stocks, bonds, derivatives, and so forth. This need to maintain the confidence of the class that can most easily collapse the financial system is what gives the profession of accounting its importance in the world. If enough people decided that what accountants are doing is really fake wizardry and trickery of some kind, and it's not a true representation of what their investment monies will actually generate, then the financial system would disintegrate just as completely as Enron did in December of 2001. So it's important for us to look at just what is going on in accounting wizardry. The accounting mirror images for stocks and bonds runs as follows. The holder of a stock or bond will record them as an asset on their own balance sheet. This asset represents the value of future cash flow or plain money from that stock or bond. The issuer of a bond, let's say some corporation, will record the same instrument as a debt on its balance sheet and will record the stock as shareholder equity. For any corporation, the following equality must hold, and that is that total assets equals total liabilities or debt plus shareholder equity. If shareholder equity starts getting too low, meaning that asset values may not be able to cover liabilities due, then the company may be forced into bankruptcy. Under both types of instrument, both stock and debt, the balance sheet items represent a promise to pay out money at certain dates in the future. For a bond or other debt instrument, these dates are fixed, and debt and interest on debt for the company takes priority over payment to any shareholders. The rating agencies such as Standard & Poor's and Moody's rate corporate debt according to the risks associated with its repayment. A less risky bond gets an investment grade, and risky bonds get rated as so-called junk. On the stock side, it is the stock analysts, usually part of the brokerage firms or investment banks, who assess what a stock might be worth, whether it is over or underpriced based on expectations about future earnings. Shareholders are entitled to all the money that's left after all other expenses and debts are paid, which is what we call profits. The value of a share in a company to the investor is the expected value of future cash to come out of that company. Thus, stock prices wobble around with expectations of future really true earnings in the form of real cash anticipated to be generated by a company. So no matter how much accounting wizardry a company has got going on to prop up confidence in its stock, sooner or later it will have to demonstrate that it can actually generate the cold hard cash expected to be generated in valuing its stock price. Stock price levels are all about confidence. Confidence that a company can generate an amount of earnings in the future to justify paying this price for the stock today. Many companies are valued, often by stock analysts, as a certain multiple of current earnings, the multiple being called the price-earnings ratio, or PER. The PER is pretty much set by market sentiment, which is pretty much based on a herd mentality. Company management therefore tries to manage earnings to make sure investors don't lose confidence in their stock. Though companies usually don't like to admit that they manage earnings as opposed to managing a business. Earnings in a period are basically an accounting item, a mere bookkeeping entry. They do not correspond to cash, or what we're calling plain money, generated in that period. And this is because, in addition to cash, earnings include all other movements in the company's assets and liabilities. And these assets and liabilities are themselves also values of expected future monetary cash flows that may bear no relation to actual money flows in the period. So much accounting creativity goes into coming up with quarterly earnings that are reported to the public through the quarterly company filings to the Securities and Exchange Commission, or SEC. Strong, steady earnings have a psychological effect on the market of inspiring confidence in a company, which leads to a strong stock value and the most desired outcome of all, which is easy access to the capital and debt markets. Any company without easy access to the capital and debt markets is likely to stumble and fail. For, without such access, they may have problems growing their business and paying bills as they fall due. Access to capital depends entirely on confidence that a company will ultimately be able to generate the required returns for their investors in the future in the form of cold, hard cash. Once just a bit of confidence is lost in a company, difficulty in getting access to capital is often further compounded by rating agencies and analysts downgrading companies and forcing even more lost confidence. Access to capital becomes even more difficult, leading to more downgrades, and so the cycle continues. This downward spiral could keep feeding on itself to ultimately force a company into bankruptcy. This is what happened with Enron. These features of the markets, and most especially the fear of getting onto this downward spiral, creates all kinds of pressures for grooming quarterly earnings to be just what the market expects them to be. We already saw that falling short of market expectations can be quite disastrous, but also exceeding them too much is also dangerous because it raises expectations for future earnings. Therefore, an ideal world for management of a company is to keep earnings growing at a level exactly as the market expects. And so we have so-called managed earnings. The challenge then is to make sure the market has confidence that those are, in fact, the real earnings of the company, that they really represent what the future holds in terms of generating cold hard cash. This amazing area of wizardry known as managing earnings seems to be a luxury reserved only for corporations. The pale faces of officials seen on TV after the Enron implosion often mention that the Enron problem might be systemic, most likely is due to the widespread knowledge that, yes indeedy, companies do manage earnings, even though what they are supposed to be doing is managing a business. But it's just one of those things everyone knows, but nobody wants to talk about it. To understand this important issue better, it is instructive to run through the highlights of an article that appeared in Fortune magazine way back in March 2001, entitled Accounting in Wonderland, where reporter Jeremy Kahn goes down the rabbit hole with GE's books, GE being General Electric. March Fortune magazine article entitled Accounting in Wonderland begins as follows, quote, General Electric is without a doubt one of the most beloved stocks in history. About the worst criticism ever leveled at the illustrious company is that its stunning run of profit growth, 101 straight quarters, is somehow artificial, the result of managed earnings. After all, the argument goes, GE never seems to have had a loss in one division that wasn't happily offset by a gain in another. Can such an extraordinary record really be the result of an uncannily canny management? or is there a bit of accounting wizardry going on behind the curtain? End quote. GE denies such allegations, and the revered Jack Welch, former CEO of GE, always said, quote, GE manages businesses, not earnings, end quote. Concerned about this accounting wizardry, Khan says he, quote, dove into GE's financial statements and wound up having an adventure worthy of Lewis Carroll. When I landed, I was in a place where little was obvious, nothing was simple, and no one, not even the number crunchers at GE, seemed to know the difference between reality and fantasy, end quote. It is an extremely difficult company to evaluate because there are so many moving parts, says a GE analyst at Edmund Jones. The moving parts range from television network NBC to jet engines and light bulbs to the largest business of all, the financial empire known as GE Capital. Khan thought he'd start his adventure there. This investigation of GE Capital led Khan to find a series of transactions and cross-holdings between various GE Capital subsidiaries that not even the GE analysts on Wall Street understood. He goes on to observe that, quote, analysts who cover the stock are much like the guests at the Mad Hatter's Tea Party, blissfully oblivious to the illogic swirling around them, end quote. This special practice in wizardry, known as shuffling numbers around the subsidiaries and associates to optimize earnings, will be important for us to remember because it's a key part of the Enron saga. Only in Enron's case, its tricks involved invisible partnerships that didn't appear on the balance sheets. Money would just appear from them and then disappear and reappear again. Funny, Khan found a similar phenomenon in the GE accounts. In his review of the losses emerging from the bursting of the internet bubble, he noted that he had no way of figuring out just how much money had gone down the tubes. This was, quote, owing to the Cheshire Cat effect. Certain investments suddenly appear, disappear, and then reappear in GE's filing with the SEC. Meanwhile, the value of some investments float, mischievously disembodied from reality. End quote. Finally, he got an admission out of a GE spokesperson, Gary Sheffer, who said, yes, there were some errors in our methodology for calculating value. And then more errors were found in some of the mysterious disappearances and reappearances of certain items. So how many accountants missed these mistakes? Jeremy Khan wondered. Lots. It should be noted here that GE has won all kinds of awards for disclosure and transparency. But what are we to make of all this when even the analysts and accountants aren't seeming to understand what's going on in the financial statements? And what of the issue of conflict of interest between a company and its auditors who review its accounts? Are they really independent when they depend on the same companies for their revenue stream? We'll listen now to some of the concerns coming out of the congressional hearings during the Capital Markets Subcommittee hearing in the aftermath of the Enron collapse. This hearing was held on December 12th, and in the following you will hear a member of this committee ask the chief accountant, Robert Herdman of the SEC, some pointed questions about the accounting profession.
But you know, sometimes there's a tendency to tell people what you think they want to hear, especially if you want to keep them as clients. And I'm just wondering, I'm not saying that ever was done, but when you're dealing with a firm, Arthur Andersen, I believe, is the smallest of the big five, about 85,000 employees. How many employees worldwide does Ernst & Young have?
Probably about 150,000.
150,000. I would imagine it's difficult to monitor the activities of 150,000 people. Try as hard and best as you can. And so I'm just wondering how we can improve the system. I know Mr. Pitt wants to improve the system. I'm just wondering if self-regulation is going to be good enough.
Well, Congressman, that certainly is a topic that has to be considered at this point. And I also would encourage you to think about the fact that big public accounting firms do have numerous controls and procedures to ensure that their people do follow the firm's policies and position.
Right. So every now and then, there's a little bit of a slip, and it amounts to $90 billion. And an awful lot of people get hurt. I'm not sure how many more $90 billion blips are out there. I do know that your predecessor, Mr. Lynn Turner, referred to the restatements that have existed thus far as the tip of the iceberg. And I'm wondering whether Enron is the tip of the iceberg.
This is all being wrapped up. I think it's premature to come to that conclusion, Congressman. I think it's very important at this point that we recognize the seriousness of the Enron matter, but at the same time, we should neither underreact to it nor should we overreact to it.
We ought to react to it very aggressively.
Yes.
Now let's focus on the amazing disintegrating firm, Enron, to study exactly how its accounting wizardry ultimately led to its demise. Before looking into the accounting wizardry, though, let's first look at what Enron was and how it grew to such great heights. To start off, let's hear the story straight from one of Enron's most revered wizards at the start of 2001, when Enron was the darling of Wall Street. What follows is an excerpt from a January Motley Fool radio show interview with now disgraced former CEO of Enron, Mr. Jeffrey Skilling.
Welcome back to the Motley Fool Radio Show, and now we're joined by Jeff Skilling, the President and Chief Operating Officer of Enron. Enron is the country's largest trader and marketer of natural gas and electricity, trades over 1,000 different commodities. Enron offers broadband services and a host of other businesses. The company had revenues of $40 billion in 1999 and $60 billion for the first 9 months of the year 2000. The stock is traded under the ticker symbol ENE. On the New York Stock Exchange. Jeff Skilling, a pleasure to have you on the Motley Fool Radio Show.
Glad to be here, David.
Let's begin by taking a look at your business model. Many people associate Enron with energy, ticker symbol ENE. That's the first three letters of energy. But in the last couple of years, Enron has expanded its reach well beyond the energy market. In the year 2000, then, Jeff, I have to ask you, what is Enron?
Well, it's a company in transition, but it's along a very, I think, very pre-planned route. And let me see if I can describe it. We were a natural gas company. We were a natural gas pipeline company back in the 1980s when that industry began to go through deregulation.
Mm-hmm.
What we found out was that as businesses go through deregulation, you have to basically remake all of the internal architecture of the industry. You know, in the old days, you had these regulatory contracts that were life of field. They were attached to pipelines for as long as the pipeline existed. It was basically a regional monopoly. They had an obligation to serve gas distribution companies. It was an open-ended obligation, went on forever. As you went through deregulation, all of those linkages that had been in place for, in some cases, 100 years, broke up.
Wow.
And you had to create markets to replace those old linkages. And so we were on the forefront in all of the 1980s on developing the original market for natural gas. We developed the original forward market for natural gas. We've developed a range of other markets like peaking supplies, regional markets, just so the customers could get access to the commodity. We did it because we were a gas company, and all of a sudden I think we realized, well, wait a minute, we're pretty good at creating these markets, and maybe this is what we are, a company that creates markets. So in the early 1990s, we did the same thing in the electric business as it deregulated. In the United Kingdom, which was our first big expansion outside of North America,
mm-hmm.
as they deregulated those markets, we went into the United Kingdom. We became the largest marketer of natural gas and electricity in the United Kingdom. Scandinavia opened up next. We're now the largest buyer and seller of electricity in Scandinavia. Australia opened up. We're the largest buyer and seller of electricity in Australia. So we just developed this model and moved it into new markets.
Okay.
Those new markets became available. And so I think that's the business model. It's a de-integrated, service-intensive, brain-power-intensive model that provides customers high value and lower prices.
COO of Enron, thank you very much for appearing on the Motley Fool Radio Show.
Thanks, David.
This bragging about Enron in the Motley Fool interview is notable for what it doesn't say. Notably, Mr. Skilling forgets to mention the serious problems Enron was facing at the time with its water privatizing extravaganza in Europe and its energy calamities in Brazil and India. We will come back to this point in a minute, But in order to understand these troubled areas, it is instructive to take a quick look at Enron's involvement in the California energy crisis, and also at Enron's attitudes to any kind of government regulation and to public goods. It's also instructive to look at Enron's involvement in shaping the Bush administration's energy policy. First, we'll listen to a bit more of the Motley Fool interview with the disgraced wizard Skilling about the California energy crisis.
By the way, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Motley Fool Radio Show. We're here talking with Jeff Skilling, the president and COO of Enron. And, Jeff, I want to ask you about a story that's playing out in the news right now, the power problems in the state of California. Now, beyond a vague sense that there's a shortage, it's hard for me to get a handle on exactly what is happening in California. I'm wondering if you could take a minute to explain what is going on and how Enron might fit into that picture.
It's actually pretty simple what's going on in California. Demand grew very quickly over the last couple of years, much faster than people expected, and we basically brought on no new additional capacity in California. So what we've got is we've got an imbalance of supply and demand. There's too much demand for the available supply.
That takes me back to my undergrad economics. I can understand that.
Now, the magnifying problem here, David, is that it's occurring in a marketplace that has been designed by the government. And what's happened is we've got a very unusual market structure. For example, the utilities were encouraged, in fact, almost forced to move to total spot purchases. They could not contract longer term for many of their supplies. And so when the supply-demand imbalance hit, it is magnified by the fact that people have to be in the day-ahead market. They can't go out 5 years or 10 years, as the industry traditionally did, to lock up supply. So as we've had this imbalance, prices have gone up a lot, and this is flowing through into the system, and it's causing enormous financial dislocations for the utilities in California because they basically have to buy very, very expensive spot power that they are mandated that they have to charge very low prices for the end-use customers. So they're building up this huge deficit to finance this thing, and it's causing some big problems.
Now, how does Enron fit in?
Well, there are a couple of things we're doing. We are doing everything humanly possible to get more power into California from places where power is in surplus. And there are a lot of places in the country and in North America where there is a surplus of power. So there are a lot of things that can be done to move more power into the state. And that's one of our primary roles is making that happen.
Now, Jeff, earlier when I asked you that question, you chuckled briefly when you described the California situation as a marketplace designed by the government. Why did you chuckle there?
Well, you know, people said that the problem in California is that they deregulated the market. That is just not the case. It's one of the most regulated markets in the country.
Okay.
We have price caps on wholesale power. We have price controls on retail power. We have a mandated federal or state-mandated power exchange that is required to do all purchases and sales of power. I mean, it's something that I think a central planner from the old Soviet Union would understand exactly.
On this topic of government energy policy, let's hear some more from the December 12th congressional hearing on Enron from a representative in the state of Washington discussing the need for a better look at Enron's involvement in shaping America's energy policy.
I represent District Governor of the state of Washington. I can tell you that my constituents have a lot of real hard questions here. And the reason is that they think of Enron as sort of a financial octopus with tentacles, not only just into the investor community, but it touches Americans in a lot of different kind of ways. And one of those kinds of ways is in the energy field, the energy prices and the like. And I heard one of my colleagues say something I guess I'll take a little issue with, to say that somehow Congress should not get to the bottom of the question of how this company hijacked America's energy policy. Because it appears from the press reports that I'm reading that there's good reason to believe that Enron's fingerprints are all over the American energy policy that exposed my constituents in the state of Washington to millions of dollars of overcharges last year in the electrical market and have led us into a situation where the country has huge failures in our energy policy. And there are questions that I think and I hope you and others help us answer, like, is the reason that we're giving Enron $254 million in tax relief instead of investing clean energy, is the answer Enron? The administration is doing nothing about global climate change? It's the answer to Enron. Is the reason the federal government's not taking action to improve automobile mileage standards? Is the answer Enron? Because there's a lot of evidence that at least we've been hearing about the ability of Enron to affect our government's policy, and we're very concerned about that. And there's a relationship between this financial world and the energy world. I think that there's a lot of questions here that are going to be related to the abuse of stockholders, to also the abuse of energy payers, consumers, and those who care about our whole energy world. And we encourage you and others to engage in trying to answer those questions that Americans have.
That was an excerpt from the December 12th congressional hearing into the Enron collapse. The Enron board and senior management clearly despised any kind of government regulation at all. In the United States, through Enron chair Ken Lay's close ties with the Bush administration, Enron was able to have troubling rules crushed and eliminated by its friends in government. This made all their U.S. investments much more valuable. Perhaps it was this ability to steamroll over democracy in the United States that led Enron to believe that it could squash regulation everywhere in the world and take over all public goods for its own private profit. Indeed, this is the approach that Enron took to water, and there is no shortage of evidence to suggest that Enron wanted to privatize the world's water. Recall that we spoke about this water market logic in Wizards Part 7. Thankfully, the water investments ultimately played an important role in drowning Enron in its own arrogance. Why? Those pesky Europeans considered water to be a public good, even after Enron went and spent all this money on water investments there. Similarly, politics and the desires of the pesky public played a significant role in devaluing Enron's energy investments in South America and India. Oh no, thought Enron. Imagine if shareholders found out that all this money was spent on water and offshore energy businesses, and now these investments were proving to be worth not very much at all. Then Enron would be in big trouble, and people would realize that it wasn't the powerful and important wizard it had been claiming to be all these years. And so, the accounting wizardry at Enron began. A July 30th, 1998 article in The Economist entitled Wet Behind the Ears begins, quote, "Allowing electricity to come in contact with water is dangerous," end quote. The article then goes on to talk about the huge price that Enron paid for Britain's Wessex water business and all the financial dangers that come with privatizing a good that everybody else in the world considers to be public. A November 2000 edition of Democracy Now! Gave a pretty thorough account of the problems that Enron was having with the government and people of India in its energy operations there. It also gave a good account of the close ties between Enron's chairman, Ken Lay, and the Bush family dynasty. Evidently, Enron thought it could carry its power over governments to the rest of the world to make them behave the way that Enron wanted them to, expecting this to happen in Europe, South America, and India. But Mr. Lay's charms didn't seem to work so well in these arenas, and Enron ended up having to stomach democratic forces in its offshore operations, and in the process was losing pots of money. Frightened of being found out, frightened of being demoted from the throne belonging to one of energy's most powerful wizards, Enron decided that honesty was the worst policy. It then cooked up some bookkeeping wizardry to hide the losses and overspending on these disastrous offshore investments that had been devalued by somewhat democratic forces. As documented in the company's third quarter 2001 SEC filing, Enron set up some limited partnerships to take the assets so troubled by democratic forces and foreign governments off of its books. One partnership was called Wyatt Wing Associates, and it owned a special entity called Osprey, which in turn brought Enron's troubled power operations in Europe and South America. Enron set up White Wing to borrow the money from outside third parties to buy the troubled offshore assets and thus hide these disastrous investments from Wall Street. But the rest of the market wasn't as naive as Enron in assuming that government regulation would soon be scuttled to provide necessary returns on capital. The investors in White Wing debt apparently thought that Enron investments were pretty dodgy and demanded additional guarantees from Enron. It is these guarantees that Enron management seemed to keep secret from everyone else and which ultimately contributed to Enron's demise. The White Wing investors, whoever they were, seemed to be pretty savvy. In order to invest in the White Wing debt securities used to buy Enron's troubled assets, they demanded that Enron agree to issue them extra Enron shares if the troubled assets were having problems generating the cash needed to pay off the debt. But the investors wanted to cover every contingency, and they knew that even this guarantee would not be good enough if someday Enron wasn't the golden child of energy anymore and its stock price plummeted. They demanded the additional guarantee that if Enron stock fell below a certain price level and if Enron debt ever got downgraded to junk, all the debt on White Wing's balance sheet would become immediately payable by Enron itself. Enron did exactly the same thing with its troubled water investments when the rest of the world was saying that they thought water should be a public good. They set up the Atlantic Water Trust and used it to set up a special entity called Marlin, which was used to raise funds in the form of debt securities. This money was then used by Marlin to buy the troubled European water businesses of Enron and take them off Enron's balance sheet so that Enron didn't have to reveal these bad bets to the street. In this way, Enron avoided taking huge losses on those bad bets to its balance sheets, and Wall Street continued to think that Enron was a powerful energy wizard. But people didn't know about all these costly guarantees granted by Enron in order to create the entities that took the assets and associated debt off Enron's books. Instead, all they saw were miraculous gains on these sales to the secret partnerships. Little did anyone know that one day the trickery would be discovered and that the debt was to all land back on Enron's books and force it to go bankrupt. All that it would take to trigger the chain of events was some small loss of confidence in the company that could ultimately send it on the type of downward spiral we discussed earlier. At some point on this downward spiral, the debt trigger in the secret partnerships would be released and things would get much, much worse. The initial trigger happened around March 2001, when all the telco companies were getting into trouble because of overinvestment in telecommunications infrastructure. Enron, having invested so much in bandwidth trading, had its share price hit by this market's downturn and by the beginnings of a general recession. Also, some of the brighter analysts were starting to notice that since Enron was really mostly a trading company these days, its price-to-earnings ratio should really be much lower than it was, and this also contributed to the share price's downwards direction. By the summer of 2001, Enron's share price had dropped to less than $40 a share, which was below the trigger thresholds on the guarantees on some of the secret partnerships. Enron management was getting very nervous that these deals might soon unravel and rear their ugly heads to the world. CEO Jeff Skilling quit suddenly. Around the same time, it was revealed that there was a whole slew of other secret partnerships called LJM and LJM2. These were involved in all kinds of mysterious relationships with special purpose entities with names like Raptor, Chuco, and Jedi. These secret partnerships and SPEs or special purpose entities were not on Enron's balance sheet, but had been run by Enron's CFO or Chief Financial Officer, Andy Fastow, who had been making handsome profits from them, according to several Wall Street Journal articles that ran in October. Enron revealed in its second quarter statement that Fasto suddenly got out of the partnerships, leading many to wonder not only what these partnerships were, but also what was going wrong with them that Fasto wanted out and Skilling had quit Enron. In retrospect, we understand that at this time certain triggers had been flipped in the partnership's guarantees and that the deals were starting to explode all over Enron's balance sheet. Confidence in Enron was dealt a further blow when these partnerships had obviously started falling apart, bringing the bad investments and associated debts back onto Enron's balance sheet. By Halloween, the SEC had launched a formal investigation into the scary energy empire. Standard & Poor's finally downgraded Enron's debt to junk, and this pushed all the triggers on the White Wing and Marlin entities so that all the debt on their balance sheets became immediately payable by Enron. Enron didn't have the cash to pay the huge debts. Nobody in their right minds would invest in them, and they were forced to declare bankruptcy. On December 4, 2001, about 4,500 employees of its Houston headquarters were marched out of their offices and told to go home. For an inside look at what this roller coaster ride was like, here is an interview I did with Ogun Coase, a former Enron employee in the global markets division and also in the risk management area of Enron at its Houston headquarters, and this interview was done a few weeks after the Enron collapse.
I joined Enron in August 2000, right after graduating from Georgetown University MBA program. Before getting my MBA, I also had an undergraduate degree in chemical engineering and then a master's degree in chemical engineering as well. After graduating from Georgetown, that time was Enron's peak time, actually, when the stock price was approximately $80-$90. It was an impressive company. We have been hearing that it also had a unique culture. So I decided personally, like many of my friends, to join Enron. So many opportunities were waiting for us. That was what we were thinking at that time. Mm-hmm. My assignments was on the Enron Energy Services side, which was power risk management, and then I moved to Risk Assessment and Control Group, which was Enron's overall risk control department, headed by Rick Bynes, mm-hmm. which is the chief risk officer of Enron, supposedly reporting to directly to the board of directors.
Can you describe, there's been a lot written in the Wall Street Journal about the environment that existed mm-hmm. at Enron in terms of pitting employees against each other, to the extent where one article, actually it recently came through in Fortune magazine, mm-hmm. talked about traders were too afraid to even get up and go to the bathroom because they thought that the next door neighbor would steal something off their screen. Is that the sort of environment that existed there?
Well, I think some sort of, because the bonus pool is some sort of thing. So if I'm getting more bonus, then somebody should get less bonus than mm-hmm. the average.
Right.
So yes, although we were working for the same company, mm-hmm. we were also competing each other as well.
Right.
As long as it's a healthy competition, no problems. But I can't say that the competition was very healthy. So, I mean, why would I help to someone else with his or her project, knowing that helping him or her would give him an extra point in his or her evaluation, and why would I do that?
Mm-hmm.
Because it might, at the end, it might hurt my bonus.
Right.
So the system was like that. It wasn't a team-based bonus system, mm-hmm. but if we do good overall as a company, you guys are going to get good bonuses. It wasn't like that. It was more personally, like, if I'm doing good, although my group is not doing well, I can get a good bonus.
So it's pretty cutthroat.
Exactly.
Okay. And you you were in the risk management area for a while, and obviously the risk management area is going to come under extensive scrutiny because, I mean, all of this is the result of the fact that Enron wasn't managing their risk very well. And did you know that anything was going on?
Enron was hurt because of the disastrous effectiveness, actually, especially in South America, in India. Well, if you're making such a big investment, you're obviously expecting really good returns from such investment.
Mm-hmm.
If you're getting subpar returns, even on top of that, if you're not getting anything, that means the initial investment that you put into that power plant or whatever that is gone.
Mm-hmm.
So how were we financing it? We were financing it, well, X percent equity, but the most of it was obviously external financing.
So you knew about all of the partnerships that was, at least some of the partnerships that were going on, some of the limited partnerships.
We were aware of the financial structure.
Right.
Obviously, we did not know how much debt was accumulated in these off balance sheet structures.
Okay. That you talk about South America and the investments in India, and obviously Enron got itself into a lot of trouble in India with the state where it set up the big power operation not paying its bills. There's also an issue of the water investments under the, I guess it was the Marlin Trust, that they had bought Wessex Water in England.
Yeah.
And was that another problem area?
Obviously, another big problem area, especially the Azurix, the water company, it was a disastrous investment.
Mm-hmm.
They thought that, like natural gas and power, like crude, water could be a commodity as well.
Right.
So that they would put pipelines for water and begin trading there on it.
Right.
They never thought about that water could be such a political commodity.
Mm-hmm.
You can stop serving net gas or power to customers, but you cannot stop serving water.
Right.
That would kill people.
Well, I guess the part of the problem is that the people in Europe were considering water to be a public good, and
exactly. And
that was the issue. Now, about those investments, the investments in Brazil and India and the water investments, was it the case, this is something I've been trying to figure out, that Enron realized after they bought these investments that they were pretty bad bets, that they probably overpaid for those investments, and they certainly weren't
exactly.
generating.
I think so. After a while, everybody realized that, okay, we were expecting such and such kind of returns from this investment.
Mm-hmm.
No money is coming back.
Right.
The maintenance costs or the operational costs or the initial investment that we were calculating is wrong. We had to spend more money than we have already calculated years ago.
Right.
It is obviously subpar return, and one way of just getting rid of these underperforming assets would be moving them to these off-balance sheet specific purpose vehicles with the debt, so that and use this these assets as collateral, so that Enron would continue raising cash.
Right.
So that you wouldn't show your debt that you took to be able to make these investments in your balance sheet.
Right. So it was actually after they bought these investments and then realized they made a mistake that's at the point that they took them off the balance sheet. Is that correct?
This is correct.
Okay.
Although it was not, and they were continuously trying to move these assets to these off-balance sheet items.
And my understanding is that the way they took them off the balance sheet and put them in a limited partnership would be to say, yeah, here's the asset, and it forms some type of collateral, and we'll use that to raise debt to basically fund the acquisition of those assets. However, what the killer to me seems to be, at least with the trust that I understand, which is the Marlin and the Osprey Trust, which basically cover the investments you've talked about, the South American and power plants and the water investments, the real killer came when Enron, as well as saying these assets are collateral, also put in the guarantees of issuing stock if the debt, you know, if the cash flow wasn't coming in, but also to say that the minute our stock price drops below a certain level, and the minute our credit rating, we get downgraded to below investment grade, that is what triggers the debt to come back
Exactly. The debtors were smart enough to put to have these two conditions.
Right.
Because of the current events, that kind of debt, approximately $4 billion, was due immediately, and Enron didn't have enough cash to cover all its debt.
Did you know that Fasto was the head of one of these, the LJM partnerships?
That information, we learned about it after Jeff Skilling quit.
Okay.
Before then, we didn't know that.
Right.
Nobody knew that.
So you basically found out when the press found out?
Exactly.
Okay.
Nobody was talking about it at that time, and nobody was expecting like that.
Do you think that you say that the risk assessment area was reporting directly to the board? Do you think that the board actually knew what was going on?
I think so.
Do you think that Skilling and Fasto will skip the country?
I think so.
Okay.
I think so.
For the holidays, all lots of Enron employees got was unemployment and worthless pension plans that had been heavily invested in Enron stock that was now completely worthless. The executives responsible for this mess have been found to have been enriched by their own stock sales and have declined to present themselves for questioning. No justice appears to be on the horizon for the rest of the Enron employees. Here's an excerpt from the December 12th congressional hearing describing just how much the Enron executives made out of this extravaganza.
Because the chairman has been very, very kind to share with us this form, this graph. And I mean, it's January of 2001, you got the insiders at Enron selling over $160 million worth of stock. Maybe you should look at that, and maybe we could find a way so that, as Mr. Konjorski, because it sounds to me that's kind of like the captain jumping off the ship. When the insiders are selling all their stock options, they're obviously not keeping them. And as we look at the sheet, you know, they sold it at the highest point, and then they went in May was the next time. And then it seems like they sell things at the highest point. They know what's going on. They're inside, obviously. They're on the inside. That's why we call them insiders. They're the executives. And if you have a CEO, as in the case of Enron, that's going to sell $100 million worth of his own stock, I think it would be good and prudent, in my humble opinion, be good and prudent and advisable for the public to know, hey, the CEO is selling all his stock. He's selling $100 million, and we know about it in January, you know, so that everybody knows, at least to that extent, what he knows. I mean, we can't put in there, like, you know, he sold it because his wife wanted a new yacht or, you know, his college tuition came up, although I don't know what college he would send someone to for $100 million, but you never know. We don't have to know why they did it, but at least know that they did it and when they did it. It's a simple suggestion because I think that way we would all know.
Would the gentleman yield?
Sure, I will.
The insider trading by members of the board of directors of a Fortune 500 or members of the management team are, in fact, tracked by the SEC, and you can read them in the Wall Street Journal on a regular basis accordingly.
Yeah, I would yield, but you know something? If you can read them, then it's interesting that nobody knew about it, and nobody read about it, and nobody made a note about it, and maybe our friends here should take a note about it and what kinds of actions they can take.
Given the Enron manager's fetish for Star Wars characters, such as the Jedis and Chewbacca, there is some comfort in knowing that this evil energy empire was defeated in part by the effect of overseas governments representing people and people wanting to hold on to public goods. The irony is that the home country's government, which we are told is the only remaining good empire these days, was the closest ally of the evil energy empire throughout the whole saga. That's all for Wizards of Money Part 8. Please visit the Wizards of Money website at www.wizardsofmoney.org for the full text of all Wizards episodes and for more references. Run for your life, they're the man.